What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It's Monday. That means Palestine Post, which we have been bringing to you over 2 years at this point, every Monday. It's where we examine Israel's U.S.-backed assaults on Palestine. We now include the region, having conversations about Lebanon, Syria, and Iran, the people's resistance to the violence of colonialism and the impacts across the globe. Our guest this morning is a return guest. Samer Arabi is the Associate Director of Political Education and Research at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He is also a member of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, or AROC, and co-founder of AROC Action. Good morning, Samer. How are you?
Good morning, Cap. Well, it's great to be here.
Always good to have you. I know I'm going to have to talk very little because you're so brilliant. And I ask a question and we get all of the things. This morning, howsomever, I'm going to start with a little bit of a different place. Yes. One of the things for me, I survived Catholic school. I should just say that. I wasn't born and raised Catholic, but I got kicked out of public school. And I ended up in Catholic school, which is actually where all the deviants from public school end up, oddly enough, and we fit in there. So I'll leave that for another segment. However, I have been fascinated of late by the verbal sparring between the Pope Leo of Chicago and Trump about Iran. But I want to roll the tape back a little bit, right? Because there was tension before that. And even though we've had pretty conservative popes, for the most part, 10 years ago, the Vatican recognized the state of Palestine. And there was some speaking out by the previous popes about what was happening there. A recent article in the Vatican News highlights, and you and I have talked about this before a little bit, that in addition to Palestinian Muslims, the attacks on Palestinian Christians in the West Bank in particular are ongoing with absolutely no response from the United States, right? We saw heightened attacks on Easter and the prevention of people being able to go to church. So normally when we have this conversation, we talk about the unholy matrimony between evangelical Christians and Zionists. But this morning, I know, long intro, but you know me. This morning, I was looking at an article in The Guardian, and it helped me start to think about, because the article in The Guardian was interviewing Catholics around, and non-Catholics, actually, around the country, asking what they thought about Trump's attacks on the Pope. And I started to think about Catholics as a voting bloc, right? We're barreling towards midterms. There's a lot of Catholics in this country. They are, in fact, everywhere. They like their Pope, right? And so as we barrel towards midterms, I'm just wondering about your thoughts about this go around, how it may or may not differ from where we were during the presidential, where we know that the issue of Palestine, we know for a fact, cool, it was a big reason why the Dems lost the presidency. They don't seem to have learned their lesson. And so I'm wondering what you think, how this is going to play out in the polls, and do the Republicans have enough wiggle room for Trump to be attacking Christian leadership in this so-called Christian nation?
But yeah, it seems like a pretty disastrous strategy, I gotta say. You know, and even I saw some polling from a few days ago, I think, that showed that something around 20% of Republicans are siding with the Pope over Trump. So, like, this can't possibly be good for him. And, like, the narrative is just not really good, right? Just being so vociferously, like, pro-war. You know, all Pope Leo is saying is, like, you should maybe be more thoughtful about murdering people. And that seems to be a thing that, you know, Trump can't abide. It's particularly fascinating to me because Pope Leo was sort of meant to be the compromise, kind of like quieter response to, you know, what we were seeing with our dear Argentinian Pope, right? Who, Pope Francis, who was a little like, was kind of a firebrand, somewhat leftist. You always got to put somewhat, and Pope Leo was like this kind of like quiet, you know, accommodating, more traditionalist kind of vision for what the Pope would be. And even then, you know, I think there's a lot of layers to this, right? There's fascinating changes within the Catholic Church generally, you know, broadly as a byproduct of the fact that Catholicism has become increasingly something, you know, associated with like working class communities and people of color. And I think that has, of course, changed the underlying politics of the church. But it's also really telling that that has made the church really turn on Palestine in a really, really critical way. And I think, you know, the attacks on Christians in Gaza and in the West Bank is a small part of it, but I think it's more broadly indicative of this sort of like global shift, right, towards this feeling of like, oh, there's clearly an oppressed people here and an oppressor. And we are, I do think starting to see that here, right? I think you're right. The Democratic Party establishment certainly hasn't learned its lesson. You may have seen here in the Bay Area that the Democratic Party, once again, on top of the issues that really concern the people here, put out a statement condemning Hassan Piker for coming to the Bay Area to like campaign with Schweikart Trucker Party. So like, yeah, we're clearly Democratic leadership and the sort of existing corporate Democratic establishment has not caught up. And you're seeing it in the elections, right? I think we're really seeing it in the midterms in a really shocking way, where the extent to which candidates are falling over themselves to show that they're pro-Palestinian and against the genocide in Israel has been remarkable, right? That we've certainly seen
Except
it
Scott
here.
Wiener, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I like the dude's got to say that he supports Block the Bombs and he thinks it's a genocide. I think that tells us something. It's obviously disingenuous. You know, you only have to look at his actions to see he's part of this group that's condemning Hassan Piker, incidentally. It would, you know, but the fact that he even has to say that, right? And he has to come out on a limb to be like, yes, I do think it's a genocide, even though he clearly doesn't. And yes, I do think we should stop weapon sales to Israel, even though he clearly doesn't. Like, that has become the litmus test for electability. And okay, you know, like the Bay Area, you can say it's a certain brand of left, but like, look at the Senate race in Pennsylvania, right? Like a solidly purple state where one of the main candidates has been, you know, screaming about the fact that she hasn't received AIPAC money. And when it turned out that she has in fact received AIPAC money, she's now canceled all of her future debates and all her public appearances. This like Dr. Stanford woman, right, who went viral for this like, you know, failing to be able to answer questions on Palestine, it may have killed her campaign, a Senate campaign in Pennsylvania. So we are in a really completely different moment. And I think that these midterms in particular are going to either cement that new reality or kind of like push it back. So it's really hard to overstate how important this particular election is going to be.
And I just want to pause before I move on, right? This is one of the moments, right? You resistors that listen to this show, inhale your victory. It's small. I know the genocides are still moving. Inhale your victory, because this is not the conversation Sam and I were having about election or electoral politics a year ago. And it's only because people have refused to go inside, and because we have this idiot that just keeps, he's the gift that just keeps on giving to conversations. For the left, and as we organize folks in the middle, we're like, yeah, but look. So staying here for a moment, US politics, there was a great Israel real estate event. It was held in Manhattan on May 5th, and some of you have heard us cover these before. It promotes property sales in Israel and Israeli settlements in the West Bank. It was held at a synagogue on the Upper East Side, and there were like intense protests, of course. It's part of this traveling expo for buying land in Israel and occupied West Bank settlements. Gush Etzion, Etzion. Am I saying that right?
Sounds right to me, yeah.
Okay, great. Well, sounds right to you then. Sounds good enough for me. The last one of these that I really heard about, like in the headlines, Samer, was in Los Angeles. This was a little over a year ago, I think. Remember, when there were big protests, and the protesters were turned on. They were called anti-Semitic, even by left-leaning Mayor Karen Bass, who was seen locked arms marching with rabbis. That was sort of it for me, and heartbreaking. Mamdani, the mayor of New York, House member, condemned this real estate sale, not for nothing, but he's quoting international law that actually,
How about that?
This isn't legal. And so I'm wondering, this may not be fair question, but I'm wondering in this moment, a compare and contrast of Mamdani and Baz, or Mamdani and sort of mayors that we're seeing in other municipalities, and again, the significance of this particular moment in electoral politics.
Totally. I think it's really indicative of the underlying shift and the extent to which the sort of like cautious, pragmatic approach has really fallen out, right? I've been following Karen Bass for a very long time. I had some dear friends, maybe former dear friends, worked in her administration. And like,
Probably the
you know,
same.
the approach has been, and I've heard this but fairly directly, the approach has been like lay low, like don't stir up controversy, don't touch the Palestine stuff because it's too controversial. It's a, you know, I don't want to mince words here. It was a really cowardly approach, right? That was designed, I think, to shore up as much kind of like right-wing support as possible. It's the Kamala Harris strategy. This is like the touring with Liz Cheney thing, right? Like, what can we do to appeal to like the right-wing base in a way to shore up our broader political support? And what we saw with Kamala Harris, what we're seeing with Karen Bass, what you know, what has been the case, I think, for a lot of these sort of like pragmatic left politicians, is the floor is falling out from under them, right? They're losing massive support. They're deeply unpopular because, surprise, surprise, you pander to the right. That doesn't actually mean that the right likes you at all, right? All you've done is alienate your actual left-wing base, while the right continues to agitate against you. So, I think we saw something really remarkable in what Zoran Mamdani is doing here, which is actually standing on principle. And that's not to say that he's not also doing a series of things that I think are, you know, attempts to be pragmatic in this broader electoral landscape. You know, New York is a whole thing unto itself. But to actually come out and just, you know, condemn the illegality of the event rather than, you know, what, ex like the way that this event was sort of insidiously designed to be portrayed, right? There's a reason they're hosting these land sales in synagogues, right? Like there's a reason they exclusively do this in synagogues, specifically so that the narrative can be people are protesting outside of a synagogue, as if the synagogue itself or the Jewish faith is something that people are somehow protesting against, which is a lie. But good luck finding that in the media coverage of these things, right? It always just says like large protest outside synagogue. You got to get to paragraph six before you get to the illegal land sales. And, you know, I think Mamdani cut through that in a way that I think allowed him to show that, you know, we can talk about the illegality of the event. We don't have to focus on the fact that it's a synagogue. And since then, I would actually say, you know, looking at the headlines just from this last event that you're referencing is the first time that I've seen the sort of traditional media reference the illegal land sales right at the top. And that's a change, right? That's a really significant change. You know, there were plenty of these in New York just a few months ago that were also just, you know, protesters outside synagogue, you know. And that's meaningful, right? And it's worth noting there are two bills that passed through the New York State Legislature about this. And Mamdani vetoed one of them. And the other one, I think, got sufficiently sort of massaged down to a point where it doesn't, in fact, prohibit people from doing this, which is protesting outside of places of worship. And that's meaningful, right? That's a meaningful step that I think actually meaningfully protects the power of people to mobilize. So that's, you know, it's really not nothing. And I think it's indicative, I think, of the way the political winds are shifting.
Before I move on, I feel like I do just have to say, and I do this every time I bring up Mayor Bass, she was my mentor. I used to say often, no Karen Bass, no Kat Brooks. So that tells you where the politics were. I will always love her for inspiring me to take this path. And so rather than a condemnation of her as a human being, it is a reflection of how much my heart has broken to watch. And it's why, you know, me and electoral politics, again, this is another segment. We try, you know, I dip my toe in, right? I personally am done with that road. I get it, right? That the reform releases somewhat of pressure on our necks, but I just think it compromises people to a point, or can. It's what I've seen happen, right? Like, I'm holding my breath around Mamdani. I'm like, okay, what is compromise? What does compromise mean? Like, what does that actually mean if you're worried about another term, right? What does that mean? What are you willing? Who are you willing to sell out? What are you not going to say? I don't for a moment believe that Mayor Bass is right. I don't believe that she believes in genocide. I just don't
Of
believe that.
course, there's no way,
I don't believe it. I don't believe that that's who she is, right? And right, holding on to that seat becomes
I know.
The goal, I don't know, y'all. I don't know.
It's hard. I don't
It's
envy
rough.
people in that position,
Me
honestly, right? Because you do have to make a series of compromises, and knowing where to draw the line is hard. And I think over time it becomes increasingly hard. But a good reminder for all of us, right? That like these people are not our saviors, you know, like the even the folks who brought us up, and some of the folks who brought me up, by the way, are working in that administration. So like
Oh,
that's really
yeah. So we're
relatable to
probably talking
me.
about some of the same people. Yeah, I always wait for like texts, like, yelling at me. But it's also a reminder that maybe revolutionaries shouldn't run for office, right? And I know that I did in 2018. And when people say, "Geez, Kat, I wish you'd won," I said, "Not me. I'm so glad that I missed that bullet." I said, because they would have killed me or recalled me in a matter of 4 weeks, right? Because I was really clear, like I didn't care about the seat. Right? It was a political position. All right, we're gonna have to break for fundraising in a minute, so let me move on real quick. Because when we come back, I want to talk about Syria, which we haven't done in a second, but I want to stay in the West Bank for a moment. A family was just forced to exhume and then rebury their father in an act of torture by the IOF. And over the last 2 days, settlers, those folks that buy property illegally, have launched a new wave of attacks, lighting fire to Palestinian homes and cars and attacking a child. What do these upticks in violence mean? And with each wave, I think this is a more important part of the question. With each wave, what are we inching towards, Samra? What gets eroded with each wave of these attacks?
The Palestinian sovereignty, right? The land, the like the possibility of, a sort of sustained Palestinian community that exists inside the West Bank. You know, this sort of fractured, like small piece of what once was, right? The like nation of Palestine now has been sort of, already, right, relegated to these like little Bantustans, these like tiny pockets of mini sovereignty within total Israeli control. That sovereignty increasingly stripped away, the land itself increasingly stripped away, but then also just the ability for people to sort of, like the extent to which Palestinian communities have become so isolated inside the West Bank, right? Unable to even go to another village nearby because they've all been cut up by these increasing number of settlements that are rapidly expanding. You know, the people who did this really horrific act that you mentioned, Kat, which is, they told this guy that he had to dig up the grave and move the body, or they were going to do it with a bulldozer and dump it on his land. Those people live in a settlement that is 300 meters away from that Palestinian village, right? And that settlement is expanding into the Palestinian area, and it continues to do so. And like, this is a horror in and of itself. And then you remember that there have been something like 50 or 60 new approved settlements that haven't even been constructed yet, in a lot of these flashpoints, specifically to sort of increase that pressure. And it's hard to understand this as anything other than genocidal, right? Like, it's a different form of genocide than what we saw in Gaza, but it is genocide nonetheless. It is an attempt to erase a people in whole or in part. And this is clearly an attempt to sort of build up enough Israeli, ultra-right militaristic presence to make the possibility of a kind of like broader contiguous Palestinian community a total impossibility. And it's working, right? Because the world is saying nothing, and they're doing nothing in response to all of this happening.
Samar, I know I said that was the last question. So quickly, impact of West Bank on what's happening in Gaza, impact on Gaza, what's happening in the West Bank. Connect those.
I mean, you hear it directly from the Israeli government that specifically talk about the Gazification of the West Bank, for example. And the idea that, like, one, the Israeli government is absolutely committed to making sure that Gaza and the West Bank never rejoin in any sort of like kind of contiguous, set of governance. There's an incredible book about this called, I think it's Hamas Contained by Tariq Bakoni. Highly recommend the Tariq Bakoni book. It's a great book.
Okay.
But it's clear that they're using the tactics developed in Gaza on people in the West Bank. And we're seeing that increasingly, right? The home demolitions, the land grabs, and also, there's a sort of tactical through line here, but there's also a broader strategic through line, which is we committed an unimaginable generational atrocity in Gaza and got away with it. And as a consequence of that, right, the impunity that they now bring to the West Bank is higher than it's ever been before. And you hear this from people living in Palestine right now that, the daily life has become a nightmare, an absolute unmitigated nightmare. And it's hard to think of that as anything other than a consequence of the lack of impunity, or sorry, the total impunity, the lack of accountability from Israel's actions in Gaza, right? And now Israel's actions in the West Bank.
Samer Arabi, let's move on to Syria. Syria's Foreign Minister Assad al-Shibani on Monday said his country wants, quote, calm and stable, end quote, relations with Israel, but is fearful of, quote, armed militias, end quote, operating from Lebanon. Samer, for those of you that watch it, Samer just grabbed his head. What does a calm and stable relationship look like with a country that's actively bombing your own? I mean, maybe I'm missing something here.
And occupying a chunk of your territory and funding and arming groups that are, trying to break away from your country. So, yeah, it's, I mean, I think we've seen for a while now the new Syrian government, allowing Israeli airplanes to cross Syrian airspace to bomb Iran and whatever. The sort of ongoing kowtowing to Israel is nothing new. And again, we've talked about this before. The new Syrian president is in a really tight bind, right? The country is completely destroyed. It's badly in need of, reconstruction assistance and foreign investment. This is the neoliberal hellscape we live in. And to do so, he kowtows to the West, right? Like that's what's been happening. And I think part of understanding that statement is also seeing some of the things that happened right around it, right? So at the same time, I think the same day, if not maybe a day before or after, they made the statement about non-state actors operating in Lebanon. Obviously, that's of extremely thinly veiled reference to Hezbollah. Right before that or right after, I really can't remember, the EU reestablished full economic ties with Syria. Right. So, like, they reopen their markets directly to Syria in a way that they haven't been in decades. And then around the same time as well, I think a little bit earlier, the credit companies and like international banks have now reopened access into Syria. So for the first time, I was in Syria last year. You pay for everything in cash, right? There's no, you can't use like a Visa or a MasterCard in Syria, that there was no access. But now there is, right? So the opening up of these markets really feels like it's tied to sort of, normalizing with Israel and sort of advancing the sort of broader Western US plans of regional hegemony and sort of giving up Syria's autonomy in the process. And that seems to be a bargain that the Syrian president and the Syrian foreign minister are willing to make, unfortunately, right? And yeah, I think it's very telling when we see the sort of, we've talked about this a lot, Kat, on the show, like differentiating between narrative shifts of political actors and then underlying material shifts, right? And the narrative shifts being meaningful, being a sort of demonstration of shifting political power and, the sort of underlying, body politic and where it stands. Again, like the Scott Wiener narrative shift is meaningful, even if there is no material shift under it. We're seeing something similar with like all these EU countries, right, who are really starting to get to the point of talking about the Israeli genocide, starting to talk about, the sort of lawless, reckless nature of the Israeli state and, condemning the Netanyahu government, whatever, whatever. And at the same time, making economic cooperation and all this stuff contingent on normalization with Israel and, the demilitarization of Hezbollah. So at the end of the day, again, we're seeing one more narrative shift without a really meaningful material shift under it,
You know,
unfortunately.
oft th this may not be a fair question either, but often the left, we folks, we get accused of like problematizing but not solutionizing, right? So if someone were to say, I don't even know if solutionizing is a word, but I'm a writer, I'm allowed, I make up words all the time. What's the alternative? Like, if you're looking for a country like Syria, who's broken the way it's broken, if they're not going to make deals with these devils, what are the alternatives?
I mean, there isn't much of one, right? And that's, I think that is the situation, unfortunately, that they're in. And this is like the neoliberal hellscape that I referred to earlier. We're in a moment where you cannot escape global capitalism. It is absolutely everywhere. And I think that is changing as the system is collapsing. So It's not inconceivable that we're seeing, for example, in a way that, countries can now shift towards China, or even Russia in some sort of like weird ways that hadn't existed before. That's not happening at a scale for like, no one is offering to bail out Syria. Well, no one is offering to bail out Syria. And the like only hope that they have in terms of getting the sort of money that they need is through these like international financial institutions, which are obviously dominated by these Western countries, this like IMF World Bank kind of nonsense that, before my current job, I actually spent a lot of time working on accountability for that kind of international finance. And it's a real, no one listening to this will be surprised to hear that it's a really nasty business. And I it's a real like rock and a hard place, kind of like, a damned if you do, damned if you don't, right? Because like this isn't actually going to fix Syria. That's the real irony, of course, that access to international funds, like loans on the international market, the reopening of like trade ties with Europe, whatever. Like that was the old model. That was the old model that led to the series of Syrian uprisings that like, through a series of like coups and revolutions or whatever, ended up producing the Ba'ath Party and the Assad dynasty and whatever. Like that model doesn't, it's colonialism, right? It's neocolonialism. And the idea of extracting wealth from this country isn't actually going to bring Syrians any respite. But they also can't do nothing. And so like that's the sort of path that they end up going down. It's even though it's more or less destined to fail. It's a real tragedy, right? And all of this, by the way, just to say that like the goal would be to achieve a modicum of the standard of living that Syrians enjoyed before this war. And that's not to, defend any like authoritarian governments that operated in Syria or whatever. We also just have to acknowledge, right, that the product of all of this was a massive, massive diminishing in a like level, a like a what's the word for like your, I keep wanting to say cost of living, but like the like standard of living, thank
Standard
you,
quality
is
of
the
living.
thing I was trying to get to. Like a marked decrease in the standard of living of Syrians, one of the most educated people on the planet, right? A solidly middle class country that is now completely devastated. And they'll be lucky, right? They'll be lucky to get back to where they were in the next 10 or 20 years, given this path that they're on. And it doesn't seem very likely. But again, this is a real problem for the left generally. Like we don't have state alternatives. We don't have a sort of alternate global pole around which we can build. It doesn't exist. Yet, we got to keep working towards building it. And I think there are some really interesting moves in that direction. But global capitalism, that's a hard beast.
I'm remiss if I don't at least once talk about Iran and what is happening there. The president, Trump, called Iran's response to a U.S. proposal totally unacceptable. And exactly what he said is Iran has been I'm gonna read it. I'm just gonna let you respond. Iran has been playing games with the United States and the rest of the world for 47 years. Delay, 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 y'all. In the intelligent way in which the POTUS talks is in all caps with an exclamation point, and then finally hit pay dirt when Barack Hussein Obama became president. He was not only good to them, he was great, actually going to their side, jettisoning Israel and other allies and giving Iran a major and very powerful new lease on life. Hundreds of billions of dollars and $1.7 billion in cash flown into Tehran was handed to them on a silver platter. Every bank in DC, Virginia, and Maryland was emptied out. It was so much money that when it arrived, the Iranian thugs had no idea what to do with it. They had never seen money like this and never will again. It was all taken off the plane in suitcases and satchels, and the Iranians couldn't believe their luck. They finally found the greatest sucker of them all in the form of a weak and stupid American president. He was disaster as our leader, but not as bad as sleepy Joe Biden. For 47 years, Iranian had been tapping us along. Don't know what that means. Keeping us waiting, killing our people with their roadside bombs, destroying protests, and recently wiping out 42,000 innocent unarmed protesters, and laughing at our now great again, in caps, country. They will be laughing no longer. Signed, President, in caps, Donald J. Trump. Sammer.
I would say that One of the really unfortunate aspects of the situation we're in is that our great enemy is just so damn funny. He's just really funny. It's
That's why
really
I read his stuff.
unfortunate.
The actor in me is
It's
like, oh, I want to
hilarious.
say these words.
Oh, he's an idiot, but man, he's really funny.
Oh, God.
But I mean, it just goes to show the utter failure that this war in Iran has been. It's really remarkable, right? And I think, as we were saying earlier, right, every crisis an opportunity, right? There incredible opportunities are coming out of the failure of this Iran war. I want to put that in context, right? This has been unimaginably devastating. A generation of people will live with God knows what consequences from, the bombing of those oil facilities, the over 1,000 people who have already been killed. I don't want to make light of any of that. It's a horror on every single front. And we're seeing the collapse of like US empire in real time here. It's a really remarkable thing to see that the US is completely incapable of moving the needle on this at all. And I think, one of the reasons we're seeing Trump sort of rail against the JCPOA, the Obama era nuclear deal with Iran, is that at this point, he'd be lucky to get anything even in that range, right? Like, with Iran has now built up so much leverage based on its ability to withstand this US assault and its unwillingness to sort of, take whatever deal is on offer that, that I think the thing that the Trump administration seems to be trying to do right now in its negotiations with Iran is to just to get a pause on uranium enrichment that is longer than the pause that was agreed to in the JCPOA. That's like the one thing that they can sort of claim that they could do better than Obama. But even that doesn't seem to be very likely at this point. And I think, one thing that became very clear in the sort of, new round of ceasefires where, somehow Pakistan always just seems to pop up and make a request of the United States, right when the United States is getting its butt whooped, right? Like this has happened now two or three times where, Pakistan has asked them to like sort of, stop fighting and go back to the negotiating table. I think the expectation from the Iranian government was, given the new reality, right, given the fact that Iran has been established as someone who can withstand these US strikes and can control the Strait of Hormuz, whether the US wants it to or not, that the US would concede some things in its demands. And when it failed to do that, Iran was like, no, like we're not willing to do this, the counteroffer, which required some really significant concessions from the US, was rejected for exactly that reason. But it's critical for us to see, right, that like gas prices through the roof at this point, very, very lucky I don't drive, but man, it's looking rough out there. The impact on food prices, overall inflation, out of control.
Airline tickets, and I don't have time to get in this, but I just had to buy a ticket. Oh my God.
Yeah, and people are feeling it, right? I think I saw some polling that said, 70 some odd percent of people have said that the increased prices have been a significant impact on them, of which I think half, like 30% or so, say that it's a major economic impact on their day-to-day lives. And so like it's completely unsustainable, right? That the cost of all of this in terms of, increased prices at home, but also the cost of waging this war, which incidentally, just as an aside, there was a new report on the reconstruction costs for Gaza, and it was something like $70 or $80 billion, which is what the US has already spent bombing Iran. Like the amount of money it would have taken to rebuild Gaza has already been spent on the war in Iran, which neither here nor there. But just to say, right, like it's a catastrophe. It's a catastrophe that isn't going to get them out of the situation anytime soon. The fact that Saudi and Kuwait briefly denied airspace to the United States in this process, very telling, right, about how the situation is changing on the ground here.
I'm glad you got that in because that is of note. Thank you so much for joining again, and I'll talk to you soon, Majid.
Thank you, Pat. Always such a pleasure. Talk soon.
Yes. Our guest today is Sam Arabi, Associate Director of Political Education and Research at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's also a member of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, ARAC, and ARAC, and co-founder of ARAC Action.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.